This program is copyright 1995 by National Vanguard Books. Post Office Box 330, Hillsboro, West Virginia, 24946, USA. All rights reserved.
They are up in Maryland, more than 30 miles from us. And since I had to take all my tools with me anyway, I took the car. They have a nice place, a large farmhouse and several outbuildings on about 40 acres of meadow and woodland. There are 8 members in their unit, somewhat more than in most, but apparently not one of them knows a volt from an ampere or which end of a screwdriver is which. That is unusual, because some care was supposed to have been taken when forming our units to distribute valuable skills sensibly. Unit 2 is reasonably close to 2 other units, but all 3 are inconveniently far from the other 9 Washington area units, and especially from Unit 9, which was the only unit with a transmitter for contacting Washington Field Command. Because of this, WFC had decided to give Unit 2 a transmitter, but they hadn't been able to make it work. The reason for their difficulty became obvious as soon as they ushered me into their kitchen, where their transmitter, an automobile storage battery, and some odds and ends of wire were spread out on a table. Despite the explicit instructions which I had prepared to go with each transmitter, and despite the plainly visible markings beside the terminals on the transmitter case, they had managed to connect the battery to the transmitter with the wrong polarity. I sighed and got a couple of their fellows to help me bring in my equipment from the car. First, I checked their battery and found it to be almost completely discharged. I told them to put the battery on the charger while I checked out the transmitter. Charger? What charger, they wanted to know. They didn't have one. Because of the uncertainty of the availability of electrical power from the lines these days, all our communications equipment is operated from storage batteries which are trickle-charged from the lines. This way we are not subject to the power blackouts and brownouts, which have become a weekly, if not daily, phenomenon in recent years. Just as with most other public facilities in this country, the higher the price of electricity has zoomed, the less dependable it has become. In August of this year, for example, residential electric service in the Washington area was out completely for an average total of 4 days, and the voltage was reduced by more than 15% for an average total of 14 days. The government keeps holding hearings and conducting investigations and issuing reports about the problem, but it just keeps getting worse. None of the politicians are willing to face the real issues involved here, one of which is the disastrous effect Washington's Israel-dominated foreign policy during the last 2 decades has had on America's supply of foreign oil. I showed them how to hook up the battery in their truck for an emergency charge, and then began looking into their transmitter to see what damage had been done. A charger for their battery would have to be found later. The most critical part of the transmitter, the coding unit which generates the digital signal from a pocket calculator keyboard, seemed to be okay. It was protected by a diode from damage due to a polarity error. In the transmitter itself, however, 3 transistors had been blown. I was pretty sure Washington Field Command had at least 1 more spare transmitter in stock, but in order to find out, I would have to get a message to them. That meant sending a courier over to Unit 9 to transmit a query, and then arranging to have someone from WFC deliver the transmitter to us. I hesitated to bother WFC, in view of our policy of restricting radio transmissions from field units to messages of some urgency. Since Unit 2 needed a battery charger anyway, I decided to obtain the replacement transistors from a commercial supply house at the same time I picked up a charger, and installed them myself. Locating the parts I needed turned out to be easier said than done, however, and it was after 6 in the evening when I finally got back to the farmhouse. The fuel gauge in the car was reading empty when I pulled into their driveway. Being afraid to risk using my gasoline ration card at a filling station, and not knowing where to find black market gasoline around there, I had to ask the people in Unit 2 to give me a few gallons of fuel to return home. Well, sir, not only did they have a grand total of about 1 gallon in their truck, but they didn't know where any black market gas was to be had either. I wondered how such an inept and unresourceful group of people were going to survive as an underground unit. It seems they were all people that the organization decided would not be suited for guerrilla activities and had lumped together in one unit. Four of them are writers from the organization's publications department, and they are carrying on their work at the farm, turning out copy for propaganda pamphlets and leaflets. The other four are acting only in a supporting role, keeping the place supplied with food and other needs. Since nobody in Unit 2 really needs automotive transportation, they hadn't worried much about fuel. Finally, one of them volunteered to go out later that night and siphon some gasoline from a vehicle at a neighboring farm. It was about that time that we had another power failure in the area, so I couldn't use my soldering iron. I called it quits for the day. It took me all of the next day and well into last night to finally get their transmitter working properly because of several difficulties I hadn't anticipated. When the job was finally done, around midnight, I suggested that the transmitter be installed in a better location than the kitchen, preferably in the attic or at least on the second floor of the house. We found a suitable location and carried everything upstairs. In the process, I managed to drop the storage battery on my left foot. At first, I was sure I had broken my foot. I couldn't walk at all on it. The result was that I spent another night in the farmhouse. Despite their shortcomings, everyone in Unit 2 was really very kind to me, and they were properly appreciative of my efforts on their behalf. As had been promised, stolen food was provided for my return trip. Furthermore, they insisted on loading up the car with a great quantity of canned food for me to take back, of which they seemed to have an unlimited supply. I asked where they got it all, but the only reply I received was a smile and an assurance that they could get plenty more when they needed it. Perhaps they are more resourceful than I thought at first. It was 10 o'clock this morning when I got back to our building. George and Henry were both out, but Catherine greeted me as she opened the garage door for me to drive in. She asked if I had eaten breakfast yet. I told her I had eaten with Unit 2 and wasn't hungry, but that I was concerned about the condition of my foot, which was throbbing painfully and had swelled to nearly twice its normal size. She assisted me as I hobbled up the stairs to the living quarters, and then she brought me a large basin of cold water to soak my foot in.